Strap on your shin pads and pump up your balls. Today, we survey the state of football magazines. From newsstand stalwarts to American upstarts, there's something for every fan of the beautiful game today on The Stack. From Midori House in London, this is The Stack, 30 minutes of print industry analysis with me, Tom Edwards. Football is the world's favourite game, but the world's most powerful country, the United States, has historically had a more lukewarm relationship towards what they insist on calling soccer. Thankfully, though, that's changing. The popularity of the sport stateside is growing year on year, and luckily for footy fans there, the country produces one of the best magazines on the market. Howler Mag began as a Kickstarter project in 2012 and has gone on to garner critical acclaim and a loyal global following. Luckily for us, its founder and editor, George Qureshi, was recently in London and he joined me in the studio. George, welcome to The Stack. Great to have you with us. Howler, I'll get the sort of fanboy bit done straight away. Long one of my favourite football magazines. Football, soccer, we're on the same page. People know what we're talking about.
There are no internet comments on this podcast.
Exactly, nothing about that. How's it all going? I have before me the beautiful winter-spring 2018 issue. How's life treating you over at Howler?
The magazine's fine. American soccer's been in a bit of a turmoil as you...
We'll come on to that in a minute.
But yeah, this issue 14, we're at work on issue 15. It's going to be the World Cup preview. Sadly, we won't be involved. But when I started this 5.5 years ago, if you told me we'd get to issue 14, I'd be pretty happy, I think.
And tell me a bit more about that sort of editorial evolution, because I guess devotees of the magazine will know an incredibly confident, vivid visual style, incredible sort of graphics. And yeah, I suppose the title still kind of evolved. Do you feel that you've got a formula that you and your team are kind of happy with? Is it a constant evolution? What's that process been like over, as you say, more than 5 years now?
Yeah, we take it where we want. There's no one telling us what to do. There are no focus groups.
Nice, isn't it?
Yeah. We don't even see page views. So it started with the premise that American soccer was a fragile thing and that it was time for us to be able to poke fun at ourselves a little bit and to explore it in a little more depth. And so we borrowed a name from your soccer culture, the Howler. It's a terrible mistake, right? So it's borne out. We've been able to sort of examine American soccer, look at international soccer from an American point of view, which is a specific thing. And it turns out because the game has history in the States, but not such entrenched tribal history, people are curious about soccer everywhere. And it's a real blessing for us because we get to explore soccer everywhere.
Exactly. And just on that American experience, because it struck me that there's been a kind of, I guess from the outside, a sort of a Europeanizing of some of the sensibilities around the game in the States, some of those club dynamics. Is that just because I'm looking to see that, because that's what I'm familiar with, or do you think that has happened a bit?
There's a really interesting tension in the United States between influences from Europe and South America. Mm. So the most popular league in the United States to watch on TV is actually Liga MX, the Mexican league. You have these cultures that don't mix all that often, but are starting to in certain ways, interesting ways in the United States. And if we can figure out how to harness those two things, we'll be a lot better for it. Right now we're seeing, you see a lot of supporters groups sort of consciously aping English fan groups or some of the tropes of an ultra group without the...
Well, I was going to say, you have ultras and you have the kind of chanting motifs and a lot of these things. Does it feel ersatz to someone who knows the global game well like you do? Do you like to see that? It's fun, I guess.
Yeah, no, of course. I mean, I like it insofar as it provides an atmosphere for the matches, right? Mm. So for so long, it was quiet. It was, that gives fans like a framework for expressing themselves and visually as well with TIFO and these displays they put out before the games. It's still relatively new. MLS is in its 22nd year. And so hopefully, my hope is that over time it evolves and it becomes our own and it doesn't feel copied and changed over from what you have going on, because we have an opportunity. So many of the things that we're copying are things that have a really sort of interesting history here, not all good, right? And so, we can hopefully change that or tweak it.
Well, speaking of not all good in recent history, middle distant history, we were talking a bit before we started recording about a brilliant feature in here about Diego Armando Maradona, to give him his full name. And of course,
I've heard of him, yeah.
Yeah, he's apparently did some good stuff on the field of play. Now, is this his...
So that is
the latest, because he's done a sort of autobiography before, I think.
That's two things. It's an excerpt from his new book, which is centered on the 86 World Cup, which for me was a formative world. I was 4 years old, so I I remember it, but I really remember it through Hero, the official film of the 86 World Cup, which, in my opinion, the most brilliant of the official films of FIFA World Cups. But it's also an original essay by his translators about what it's like to translate Diego Maradona. And that, to me,
interesting, to say the least.
Oh, my right? God. It's crazy.
This is a guy who, I guess, his motifs, his speech styles, his personality, absolutely as exuberant as his on-field persona.
Oh, yeah. Right? And you've got the dialect from Buenos Aires, and then you've got sort of the way his mind works as well, which is totally, if you've seen him play, you have some sense of how he thinks.
Now, the reason that I joke about this being slightly contentious, certainly on this side of the pond, is, of course, he scored the hand of God goal, which is what you were referring to knock England out of the World Cup. He cheated, in essence, by scoring a handball. Not allowed to use your hands as an outfield player in the beautiful game, of course. But he's the classic anti-hero. And I guess that's the sort of person that you return to in Howler quite often. I cannot think of a sporting figure that the English have loved to hate so much.
Not just that goal or not just that figure, but that match for me holds so much of what I love about the game. I mean, you have that goal, right? Infamous. And minutes separating it, you have what many people consider the greatest goal ever scored.
I would grudgingly concede it's right up
there. Yeah. And so to me, you look at the game of soccer and you have utter lowness, like just base behavior, and you have the most sublime thing you can imagine. It's beautiful. And so it's
the perfect distillation. It's like legend. Here's a question for you, George. If someone's not familiar with the magazine, can you boil down the visual approach that you and the team have to Howler? I don't know, I've sort of said striking, inventive, but I still feel that doesn't really do justice or get to the heart of it. Can you boil it down into a word or ten?
I usually start with the illustration and the photography. A lot of it's, you know, all the illustrations commissioned by us. A lot of the photography is original. And then there's design. We have a new design firm working with us for this issue and moving forward, and I'm really excited about what they're doing. You saw the Maradona spread, which is just a gold fist on this navy background. To me, that was something I didn't think of. That was their idea, and it was genius.
It's kind of understated, and understatement is not something you'd associate with Diego, but it works just right, doesn't
right,
it?
Right. And so our premise is that for any magazine to survive in print right now, it has to just grab you visually. Otherwise, make a website, or publish it as a journal or whatever. It's if you're going to go to the expense of printing it and making it big and heavy and beautiful, hopefully, if you agree, do it up, you know?
Let's talk a bit more about Howler, finally. What are some of the things on the horizon, short-term, medium-term, big ambitions? I don't know, we can be as vainglorious and unrealistic as you like, George. What should we look forward to? And maybe I think you can tell our listeners how they can get hold of copies and find out more and all that kind of thing.
Yeah. We are working on issue 15 right now. It's the World Cup preview issue. Everything we do, we have to think a little differently than a website or a weekly magazine. So, everything we do hopefully has a shelf life. It has some value beyond the event. For instance, we've got an amazing profile of Antonio Conte, and it turns out that everyone in his hometown hates him. And so we have this really fantastic profile of him that is actually about modern celebrity and what it means to be loved and hated by people who have never met you. So things like that. We have our World Cup miniseries. We have a podcast called Howler Radio coming out. We did a European Championships miniseries 2 years ago. An actor named Anatole Youssef, he played a gangster in Boardwalk Empire, who I don't know if you guys watched that here, but
very much.
He's fantastic.
I devoured all of it,
yeah. And he performs these for us, and they sort of look back at certain aspects of the tournament. So that's on the horizon as well. And you can get the magazine at shop.howlermagazine.com. I hope you don't mind. I made a discount code for your listeners. It's just Monocle, and that gets 20% off a subscription and a free patch. We made one of the patches from that.
I have one here. Yeah, this doesn't work on radio, but it's a nice, it's a beautiful.
You can
thing
scratch
to behold
it and let people know it's real.
Yeah, here you go.
Yeah, there you go.
That's the sound of it. It's a real physical item, people. Thanks again, George, for coming to see us. And I should remind our listeners that issue 14 of Howler is on all good newsstands now. In a moment or two, a roundtable review of some of the footy fare on newsstands at the moment. But first, some news from the wider world of print this week. Billionaire Patrick Soon-Shiong reached a deal this week to buy the LA Times and San Diego Union-Tribune newspapers. He's agreed to pay $500 million for the Southern California titles. It's hoped the new buyer will improve the prestige of the 136-year-old paper, which is running behind its main competitors when it comes to resources and influence.
The New York Times has released promising numbers about their subscription revenues. In the last quarter of 2017, the company added over 150,000 digital subscribers and registered their highest ever annual subscription income of $1 billion. And Brazil's biggest newspaper pulled its content from Facebook after an algorithm change. Folha de São Paulo claims the social media website is encouraging fake news. The breadth of football magazines out there might take a non-fan by surprise. We thought we'd offer something of a primer in the form of a roundtable featuring myself and two of my more football-minded, or I might say crazed, colleagues. Monocle's chief sub-editor Dan Poole and managing editor Tom Reynolds are here in the studio alongside me. Dan and Tom, thanks for being on The Stack. Now, we should alert our international listeners that this may be slightly parochial, but go with us because I think there's lots of interesting things that we can look at through this particular prism.
And Tom, I want to ask you, there's a couple of sort of European titles, if you like, which are sort of larger format, black and white, very striking, and they kind of look like they would be happy shelf fellows with fashion titles. Do you think that there's an unease from certain fans of football about the way the game, I guess to some minds, has been sort of appropriated by the wealthy, by the middle classes, if you like? Because that's obviously an issue, like, in terms of the game and the finance of the game and who goes to the matches. But does that also speak to a dynamic in the media landscape as well?
Well, it's tricky. I mean, when I was at the Green Soccer Journal, we were all big football fans. That's all we talked about. But we also had, you know, an interest in design, an interest in fashion. And not just like our clothes that you wear to the terrace and stuff. It was, you know, we picked up fashion magazines and we would read them and we would talk about it. And you know, I was longing to see this sort of thing on the newsstand that wasn't just the back pages of the newspaper or a fanzine. There are, you know, they have their place and they are important, but I wanted to see something a bit more glossy with a front cover to rival, you know, to rival Vogue, to rival these things that are on the newsstand. And there are a few that have come out like that. And one magazine here called Undici, I think I'm pronouncing it right, it's an Italian publication. And the first thing I noticed when I picked this one up is not only is it glossy and perfect bound and a striking cover image, but the inside front cover is an ad by Rolex. You know, and these are luxury brands that are advertising in huge magazines, and it's like, oh, brilliant, they're getting recognition, they're getting funding from these people to produce it, so it doesn't have to be, you know, a £30 cover price just to pay the print bill.
You wouldn't have seen that in a terrace scene in the 80s.
No, no way. I'm not sure if they'd be interested.
And Dan, what about the quality of the writing? Because I guess one thing that's interesting is there's always very serious, sometimes rather po-faced, straight-laced writing about the game in, say, traditional newspapers. One imagines there might be a divide between that sort of more blokey, terrace, banter, zine style. But does the profusion of magazines, just the sheer amount that's out there, mean that actually good writing about football, wherever it's kind of coming from, is available in more places? I mean, is that true, or is that, I guess that's a process that's kind of still happening?
I think it's still evolving. I think there's still room for both, which isn't to say that, bringing up again late tackle here, it's not to say that the writing in it isn't good, but it's got a certain tone that some of these other indie magazines aren't adopting, and it wouldn't ever want to do that. If it was a footballer, it's Steve Claridge with his socks around his ankles, whereas we've got something like...
Google him, international listeners.
whereas Soccer Bible here is more like Thierry Henry, for example, who you won't have to Google. I think there's room for both. And it's not to say there's bad writing. It's like writing in The Sun, say, is aimed at a Sun reader and it's written in a certain tone. Writing in The Guardian or The Times is written in a completely different tone. It's not to say that either is bad or good. It's just that they're aimed at different audiences. And obviously, the range of people who watch football and read about football is very wide as well. You've still got working class, the traditional working class people turning up. You would imagine, not wanting to tar with a brush, but maybe going to watch more of the sort of lower league football, perhaps, whereas a lot of people now who watch the Premier League are middle class and upwards. So the whole range needs to be covered in what's on the shelf as well.
What's your favourite kind of football journalism, Dan? That's a bit of a kind of open question, but because I guess all these different things we've been talking about have different appeal, but do you have a particular thing that just pleases you more than another for whatever reason it might be?
I do like the nostalgic stuff, because obviously even at the tender age of 35, and still you still hanker for the good old days. And so reading about, I mean, and for the autobiography we've mentioned that I'm writing, that's a guy who was playing or started out in the early 90s. So all of that kind of anything about any footballer from the 90s is going to immediately get my attention. And as a Manchester United fan, pretty much anything written about Manchester United is also going to get my attention.
So you're quite well served then, being a nostalgic Man United fan, right?
Yeah.
That's a good demographic to be in.
There's lots to get there.
Tom, what about other sort of new entrants into the space? So in this programme, we're hearing from CARICOM, for example, which is coming at this from almost a completely different point of view. You almost feel it's a market that suffers from saturation. But presumably, if you have a great idea, as with any busy marketplace, there's still a platform from which you can make your voice heard?
Yeah, I think there's definitely been an influx in football magazines, especially, I mean, I don't know if I've just noticed it since I started working at the Green Soccer Journal, but there's so many more independent options that you can go to and you can pick up, and it's a different angle, a different edge. But the interesting thing is, and you know, I know this from working at the mag, is getting access to players is pretty much impossible. You can read an interview with a footballer and then you'll read another interview with someone else. It's exactly the same. They're saying the same things. They've been completely media trained. The brands are getting involved. The agents are getting involved. The clubs are getting involved. And then, you know, the mag's getting involved, whoever you're writing for. So it's just watered down. So the interesting thing, I think, is they're talking about a subject about people who can't really talk and tell you about what they're doing and tell you about their games and give their opinions, but there's so much writing around it. So it's experts' opinions, you know, nostalgic pieces, stories that have come up in the past. And, you know, a good example is The Blizzard, which is a magazine run by Jonathan Wilson, I think.
Yeah.
So he started it up and he wanted to produce something that journalists could write about. So they're not restrained by the newspaper, they're not restrained by the brands and the players and the agents. They could just write and it would be published. And they've got a subscription. It's all run on subscriptions, and they pay the writers a kind of dividend of the profits for each issue. But you know, I picked up that I've read some super interesting things in there about the Danish team FC Midtjylland, who did the Moneyball structure, and they managed to win the Danish league, which was dominated by FC Copenhagen for years. And suddenly, by signing players on statistics only, for very low fees, they managed to win the league, which is super interesting. Yeah, it was talked about a bit here because they got into the Europa League, or they're trying to get into the Champions League. They played against Man United.
They lost heavily.
Yeah. But, you know, that's stuff that you wouldn't pick up in detail in the newspapers. And
on that as well, talking about the fact that, yeah, because that's true. Often you ask me what I like reading about. Often an interview with a player is not going to be that great, particularly the ones at the higher levels of the league. And so what a lot of these magazines are doing, something like Soccer Bible that we've got here, I noticed there's interviews in there with people like, there's a member of The National. There's an interview with the actor Johnny Harris. It's talking to them about their thoughts on football. So it's like they're coming at it from a different angle and as a result, making it more interesting than just actually going direct to the source.
Well, just to jump in, one of the best sports profiles that I've come across is a profile of Kobe Bryant, basketball player in the New Yorker. This is while he's still playing, so he's top of the game, still playing, big contract with Nike. You know, so many people around him. But there's something about American sports where they do get this access. You can speak to players, you can follow them around. They're with him for, you know, a few hours here and there, a couple of days, and you know they took 2-3 months to write the piece. And they got unbelievable access and some amazing stories. And there's something about the football industry where they don't want you to get close to the players like that. And I thought, you know, maybe in the US now they're getting a lot of, well, they have done for a lot of years, a lot of star players over there. I thought, oh, you know what? Maybe a magazine will go over to the US, they'll have easier access, media access. They'll get a great profile on Steven Gerrard for once. Let's see if there's anything between his ears, you know, anything going on in there. But no, it didn't happen.
Monocle's chief sub-editor, Dan Poole, and managing editor, Tom Reynolds. Thank you both very much for joining us this week on The Stack. Finally on today's show, CARICOM is a new magazine from writer and editor Callum Jacobs, which looks at the intersection of football and the black experience. It offers a critical perspective on issues that are deeply ingrained in football but often ignored. Here's Callum in conversation with our programme producer, Henry Rees-Sheridan.
I've been writing about race in relation to sport for the past 4 or 5 years. But as a struggling writer as I was then, I didn't know where they would fit, where I could pitch them, how to pitch them. So it was always kind of a desire within me and a passion within me to kind of consecrate them all in one space. I think also that football is a great space to talk about multiculturalism and race, just because there are so many different nationalities entwined within the game. I think that it's the only, well, one of the only industries where meritocracy and multiculturalism combine to enrich the spectacle. I think you can see teams in the Premiership that are comprised of players from all over the world, and these players will have traversed continents on their way to coming here, and they would have grown as people and learned a lot. And it's not really, in my experience, and a lot of our experiences, entirely reflective of the society that we live in, as much as we'd like to feel that it is. Well, I think we're some way off where footballers are or have to be to progress.
So, Callum, you mentioned that you were struggling for a while to kind of find an outlet for your thoughts and your writing about race and football. Was that partly to do with a conservatism within the kind of mainstream sports news media?
Definitely. I think presently we're moving through a period of time where people such as myself and others are able to kind of gather a sense of agency behind the issues that we face. And I think, yeah, there was a definite conservatism. I'd say up to even 3 years ago, we definitely wouldn't be in a space where there could be massive think pieces about sexual harassment or, you know, exclusion from certain industries and things like that. So I think that definitely held me back. I don't want to say as if I'm jumping on the bandwagon and that's why I released it now. I released it now because I felt somebody else would. And I felt that I needed to kind of put my stamp on it and my mark on it and say, this is something that I've done. It's definitely been a bit more easy to express these views now.
And what about sports writing and sports media and even more particularly football writing? Were you dissatisfied with the kind of questions that were being asked in the sports pages?
Football is my favourite sport, but I'll read long form cricket or baseball and basketball just because it's so... It's just great, and I read a variety of newspapers and I listen to podcasts, but I did always feel there was something missing from the conversation when the people tasked to cover the incident or whatever had happened wouldn't be reflective of the person they were talking about. Their backgrounds wouldn't be, and I think obviously in that instance there'd be something missing. So when the Suarez and Evra incident happened, I listened to around 5 podcasts and they all talked about it and they all covered it well, I'd say. But
just give us a very brief capsule background on that.
Of course. So Luis Suarez, a Liverpool striker, called Patrice Evra a negrito, I believe. And then the speculation around it kind of turned into, did he mean it? Was it affectionate? I don't know why he would be affectionately referring to an opposition player in that manner, but anyway, and then everyone kind of cast their judgment on it from afar, because obviously no one had direct access to Luis Suarez or Patrice Evra. And yeah, so the majority of people tasked to write about this incident were white, and they were great writers, all of them, or the majority I should say, but none of them came from Evra's background or Suarez's background, I should say, to be honest. And I think I was dissatisfied with that. And just in general, if you look at interviews, I did an interview recently with a footballer from the Ivory Coast, and we were able to talk about things that I'm fairly certain a white journalist from Britain may not be able to talk to him about. So we talked about the immigrant experience, coming to a new country and having to learn the culture and having the issue of cultural enclavement at home, where you're family and friends behave a certain way and eat certain food and talk a certain language, and outside of that it's different. And we were able to talk about that, and I think afterwards his management actually got in touch and said they were really happy with the way I spoke to him, because I engendered an openness in him that other writers hadn't to that point, which was really flattering but also really edifying.
We've got a copy, I think the copy, right? This is the first issue of the mag in front of us. It's got a really striking black and white cover with just the word CARICOM on it. But when you open it, it is kind of really delightful, quite restrained but colourfully designed magazine. Do you want to talk me through just maybe two or three features within it that you feel kind of really represent what you're trying to get at with the mag in terms of tone and content?
Yeah, so I think you're right in saying it's a restrained kind of visual collection of writing and images, because we did note that being a magazine that explored the black experience, and, you know, people might suspect that we'd go down a very urban route, which is fine, which there's a lot of content out there which is quite entertaining, which I will consume at times. But yeah, we did decide to draw back. So I'd say the photo series in here, which is a Sunday League teams, which was donated to us, I'd say that's probably one of the most affecting photo series in there. Because so I saw this photo book, Sunday League, a few years ago, and I noted the amount of all black teams that were in there. So then I decided to kind of explore why there are all black teams, and I reflected on times when I was in all black teams, and I kind of realized it was a sanctuary almost for me. Not to say that diversity isn't a great thing, of course, but when you are in that black team, you can kind of just fully be yourself. You never really have to explain anything away or modify yourself or subtend the things that you say for other people. So I'd say that was quite a potent thing we did. And there's also a piece of artwork in here, and it's Pogba. Well, it's an outline of Paul Pogba surrounded by his Man United shirt, kind of obscured by them, and they're kind of cascading in front of him. And that kind of speaks to how he's been commodified and how black culture is commodified and used, but that black lives are not. And so, yeah, so those are two really quite affecting things that I like, that we did inside the magazine.
One of the most interesting pieces, I think, in CARICOM looks at racism within sports commentary and within athletic analysis. Tell me about that piece.
Yeah, that piece, Sporting Stereotypes, touches on what I felt was a quite familiar and obvious concept, where black athletes are judged and kind of described using language that is rarely used to describe white athletes. So whereas white athletes are good, honest professionals, James Milner, for example, black athletes are a beast or a monster. The language that commentators use to describe black players, like he's a bad boy or he's temperamental, you don't know what you're going to get from him, it's things like that, like he's a mercurial character. I've actually been described that way in my own workplace. So I think,
not in relation to your football skills?
No, not at all. I'm terrible.
But
I think that language bleeds out into wider society, and I think, well, football's massive. So the narratives and the language that builds up around black athletes using that language kind of has calcified and does affect wider society. So I thought I should just get in there and talk about that, because it's quite casual, and I think it's subconscious, and I think it's lazy more than anything else.
Where will you be looking for future contributors, or where are future contributors coming from? I'm just interested in understanding, like, are they established journalists? Are they people who perhaps work in, like, ancillary fields? Are they sports people?
At the moment, the most responses I've had are from artists and illustrators who I think visually can tell a story very well, kind of intuitively. Where I'm going to look for them, I'm going to do an open call, I think, just because I want to give opportunity to people. I think if I can offer people legitimacy and credibility through CARICOM, then that'll translate well.
Any listeners who are keen can get in
touch?
Yeah,
definitely. CARICOM.UK is the website, and CARICOM Web is the Instagram and Twitter, and I run them both, so you speak directly to me.
Callum Jacobs from CARICOM speaking to Henry, and issue one of the magazine is out now. You can find out more at CARICOM.UK. Well, we've zigzagged to the onion bag and hit the back of the net on this week's programme. That's it. Thanks to our producers, Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Henry Reese Sheridan, and our editors, Cassie Galpin and George McDonough. Comments or queries are welcome. Send them, I'd like to think, in the form after this week's theme of a match report to Fernando at fp@monocle.com. And don't forget to join us at the same time next Saturday, when Saturday comes, one might say. You've been listening to The Stack. I'm Tom Edwards. Thanks for listening.